B-Pod Studios.
What are the new trends emerging quickly that impact our business? Who are the thought leaders bringing these new products to market? And what lessons in leadership can we bring to our everyday life? Beasley Media Group Executive Vice President of Strategy and Innovation, Buzz Knight, brings all of this to life with this podcast, Healthy Paranoia.
On this edition of Healthy Paranoia, I'm thrilled to speak with the authors of the national bestseller, Detonate, Why and How Big Corporations Must Blow Up Best Practices and Bring a Beginner's Mind to Survive. Jeff Tuff and Stephen Goldbeck are my guests. Jeff is a principal with Deloitte here in Boston and is the senior leader of the firm's innovation and applied design practices. And Stephen Goldbeck is also a principal at Deloitte and serves as chief strategy officer and a member of the firm's executive leadership team. Jeff Tuff, thanks for joining us in person here in Boston. And Steve Goldbeck, thanks for joining us via Skype from New York City for Healthy Paranoia.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
So what was the initial motivation for your book?
So quite honestly, so as provided in the intro, Steve and I are career-long consultants. Well, that's not entirely true. Steve had some stints in industry, but I've been a career-long consultant. And when we first got together talking about a book that we'd like to write, one of the things that occurred to us is that we show up at our clients at their sites and always end up engaging with people who, you know, when they're outside the official meeting or they're outside of whatever the immediate purpose of getting together, are always saying, you know, why do we have to do things this way? It drives me crazy that X happens, or it drives me crazy that Y is asked for by me on a regular basis. And we said, look, wouldn't it be interesting if we wrote a book about all the things that drive our clients crazy and that might have at one point made sense to be ingrained in the business culture and in the processes of the business, but now no longer make any sense whatsoever. And that idea eventually unfolded and turned into Detonate.
So you're the guys that pop into town, drive the local team crazy, give them tons of things to think about differently, and then you hop on the plane. Is that what you're telling me?
I think that's the standard view of consultants. I think both Steve and I hold ourselves to a slightly higher standard, as does our firm generally. But we like to stick around and work through the implementation of our ideas with our clients, and that's how we get to know them so well and know the things that are actually driving them crazy.
Yeah, and in my particular case, Buzz, part of my job is to be a permanent advisor to our executive team in my role. So I you know, when it comes to helping try to detonate the things that we're doing as Deloitte to be more competitive ourselves, there's no hopping on a plane and escaping the realities of our day to day. So,
and Deloitte covers a wide swath in terms of product categories that you consult. That's correct.
Yeah, we've got a series of many different businesses under the Deloitte umbrella. So we've got a consulting business which runs all the way from a technology practice to working with human capital to all sorts of different advisory services from strategy and other elements of operations. To having a risk advisory practice, a financial advisory practice, in addition to our tax and our audit practices that we have. So it's a wide scope of professional services that Deloitte has under our
umbrella. About as wide as it gets, I would say.
So how did businesses get into this habit of following best practices? Can you trace historically how this all started in any way?
Well, I'm not sure I can put my finger on exactly where it started, but I can tell you what Steve and I have concluded about why these best practices came to be so dominant in most businesses. And the simple reason for it was that companies and executives at companies were trying to manage risk out of their business. It seems like a totally logical thing to do. If you're meant to be a profit-oriented entity, then you want to take out any of the things that might stop you from making a profit. The world that businesses grew up in, and the world up until about 5 years ago, moved at a pretty predictable pace. And, you know, that Steve and I talk about the difference between the rate of linear change versus the rate of exponential change in the book. And even though there was some uncertainty in business of the past, and even though markets didn't move perfectly predictably, they moved slowly enough and on a kind of linear progression that you could kind of course correct and anticipate certain things, anticipate competitive moves, anticipate how the market was going to react to a product you might launch out there. And if you got it right, great, you keep on going. If you got it wrong, you still had time to correct things. And so because that was the nature of business in the day, you could actually use analytical methods and certain types of protocols and playbooks to be able to assess what's likely to be the reaction of the market and then to take risk out of the business. And so what did end up developing over time were a series of protocols to do exactly that. That's all over. We're now living in a world where linear change is no longer the norm, and exponential change, as we talk about in the book, is really what most executives have to contend with. And if you try to apply playbooks that are meant to manage risk out of a linearly changing world, instead of recognizing that the opportunities today are governed more by uncertainty than by risk, and then you're going to end up doing real harm.
Steve, anything you want to add to that, and in particular, reinforce?
Yeah, and well, the one thing that I constantly see executive teams implicitly doing is assuming that doing the same thing that we've done forever is somehow riskless, right? Like when they have conversations about whether or not they should make a substantial change, the conversation is always to some extent, well, doing something different is really risky. And somehow they're implicitly saying that the thing that we, if we just continue doing the thing that we're doing, that's riskless. And in fact, what I guess Jeff and I's thesis is that increasingly doing the same thing is actually more risky than trying something different. If you believe the world's moving as quickly as I think many of the executives that we talk to on a daily basis believe, that is actually a risky thing to do. It just doesn't feel risky because it's what's known. And increasingly, you've got to be willing to just say, like, what's actually, that is a risky thing to do. And the risk and the less risky thing is to try something different in a small way to see if it might work better.
So do you see companies that are gung-ho about detonating? They say they're ready. They believe in it. They buy where you guys are going. And then when you really dig into the core, they're not so ready.
Fantastic question. I would say we have both been really pleasantly surprised by the market's reaction to the book and the ideas in the book. And I would say on an individual basis, the people that we speak to in big scaled corporations, because it should be said that Detonate, while the principles in Detonate apply to any sort of business, the target audience we had in mind and a lot of the case studies that we used in the book were big, successful companies. So companies that have been around for a long time, they've got an established business model, and they're really successful and therefore less likely to want to change things. So individuals in those companies will happily say, there's all this stuff I do that just drives me crazy. I don't see how it's adding value. But when you actually go to try to change those things, that's where the antibodies come out of the system and try to protect the core, because the core is what the successful business model that is yielding the profit and the cash to be able to fund the rest of the system. And those antibodies are certainly not dumb, and they're certainly well-intentioned, but their job is to protect a core business. And you just can't you just can't accomplish some of the things that we talk about in Detonate if you try to address those antibodies head on.
Yeah, and Buzz, what we think is at the centerpiece of the resistance is something that we call in the book Me Inc. And this is where, you know, every individual in many of these scaled organizations is trying to do whatever they believe will make them personally successful. And organizations who are really gung-ho about detonating oftentimes don't realize the very thing that they need to change is the system of incentives and structures and processes that, you know, give rise to the belief that if I act in a way that's consistent with how I've acted before, I'll be successful. If organizations want to detonate, what they need to do is change the motivations of all those individual Me Inc. so that they behave in a different way. But oftentimes leaders get up and say, we want change and ask for change without actually giving the real underlying motivation for that change. And so that's the place where we think organizations need to start and look hard.
Can you talk about some companies that you feel have successfully followed the principles of Detonate?
Sure. Yeah, there, we mentioned a few in the book. There's one. Why don't I tackle one of them, and then Steve, you pick your favorite example. But you know, I don't know if you know this company, Buzz, but Edible Arrangements is that striking a chord? Mm-hmm. Really interestingly, as we were writing the book, Steve and I started to see some articles about the mindset of the CEO of Edible Arrangements and what he says about why the company will continue to be successful. And what he basically said, and I'm paraphrasing this, so I think this is roughly right, is every 5 years, I want to burn down the business model. I want to completely reset the thing and be able to adjust to what our customers and our market is looking for in the moment, not based on how we've run things in the past. And so we thought that was a really interesting and concise way of conceiving of the types of things that we were talking about. But it must be recognized that's a small-ish company. You know, it's reasonably new to the world, and it doesn't have the established legacy that a lot of the companies that Steve and I consult to on a daily basis have to wrestle with. There are some examples of bigger companies detonating in small ways, but overhauling the entire system, I think the examples are really few and far between.
Yeah, Buzz, if Jeff and I had a long list of companies that do this well, I don't think we would have had the impetus to write the book. You know, my favorite example, because it's a leader that Jeff and I know well, is out at Levi's, and their success has been they turned around a business that had been in slow decline for a long period of time, as they brought in a leader who had never really run an apparel business. In fact, what he did, a fellow by the name of Chip Berg, as he came in from Procter & Gamble, people were aghast at within the old halls of Levi's, or aghast that they brought in someone who doesn't have any apparel experience. And Chip's mindset was, with his new team, was teach me the apparel business. But his ability to ask the silly questions allowed him to identify longstanding orthodoxies at Levi's, which has in turn, over his period of time, turned around the business from a declining company to a growth company, and they recently were just successfully went public. And ultimately, the best example that Jeff and I point to, although it seems cliche in these times, is Amazon, which has reinvented itself from a physical bookseller to a digital bookseller to a seller of everything to disrupting the grocery store business to getting into content. That's a company whose relentless pursuit of reinventing itself is I think the ultimate poster child for what we see in Detonate.
So obviously companies and businesses being ready to adapt to change. I know we talked offline a little bit about maybe some opinions, Jeff, on the radio business and how it can consider these principles. Jeff, maybe you could talk about it from at least your view. And I know Steve's got some direct thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, well, so much like any industry or any company within an industry, the place this needs to start is to recognize those so-called orthodoxies that Steve just mentioned in his story about Levi's. So orthodoxy, the way we use the term in the book, is just a kind of it's an all-encompassing term to capture the notion of the conventional wisdom that's just kind of out there in the air. It's the way we do things. It's the way we've always done things. Sometimes it's talked about and written down into playbooks or into protocols. And sometimes it's just kind of there. It's the, what you learned the first day on the job. And you just kind of that, a meeting runs when someone comes in and starts the meeting and reads an agenda. And that's a trite example, but orthodoxy is all around us in any company that we work for. And orthodoxies exist as it relates to the company, to the industry, to our belief system around how competitors work, et cetera. So the way you start any sort of detonation, if you will, is to just make the orthodoxies discussable. Start talking about what are the things that we just kind of do by rote, that we just believe about the way that this industry, if it's the radio industry, that the radio industry, what we believe about the way it works. And my guess is if you start that exercise, you'll start to identify some things that have always been true and will likely always be true in the future. But then you'll find yourself talking about something that was probably true 25 or 30 years ago and that governed some good common sense back then, but no longer makes any sense in this day and age. And so the trick in this orthodoxies conversation is to honor the orthodoxies that have good structural reason for being there and don't try to blow up everything, but try to identify the things that really are rooted in old and stale conventional wisdom and then try to operate differently.
Well, and maybe to bring what Jeff's saying to life specifically about radio, you know, as I've worked with radio businesses over the years, one of the biggest orthodoxies for from my standpoint is that radio itself is an industry. Yes, there are you know, legacy radio stations and legacy radio businesses, you know, that compete with each other in a traditional fashion. But the fact is that those same businesses are competing for the time and attention and advertising dollars with media that have substantially more dynamic presences with visual depiction as well. So radio started in a world where that was the extent to which the technology was able to deliver content. And radio stations had a longstanding source of advantage, which was there was only so much spectrum to deliver that content into a DMA, and there was only so much attention you could garner from an advertiser. So it was easy to some extent, you know, create content and then sell advertising dollars against that content. Now, when basically that exact same business model can be replicated exactly with a few lines of code by, you know, companies like Spotify and all those competitors, and there are more compelling media in terms of the kinds of things that would capture listener attention, that include audiovisual, the radio business has to figure out what customer need it's going to solve that fits into it. And certainly a lot of the customer needs have been declining in terms of share of occasions. Like, you know, while drive times have been extending, there's now other forms of ways to serve those customers' attention. So the orthodoxy that I think the radio business needs to blow up is that it's only competing in the radio space. It's competing in the attention space. And figuring out how, given the technology it accesses, can solve customers' needs would be one first orthodoxy to blow up, Buzz.
And I will say, you know, in the book, we focus a good portion of the attention of the book, the middle part of it, identifying the seven, what we call the seven deadly playbooks, the things that typically show up in companies as being most problematic. Some of those may apply to the radio industry, some of them may not. But we do end the book with four core detonate principles that I think radio, much like any industry, any company in any industry, it would be helpful to pay attention to, because I think those four principles we identified really are in some ways universal.
And you talk also about the importance of having the beginner's mindset here, yeah, as sort of that different perspective. I often wonder while reading the book, you know, how we in radio could benefit from the beginner's mindset as well.
Yeah, so that's actually one of the four principles that we talk about. So if it would be helpful, why don't we just run through those very quickly and talk about how they link together? And there's two in the book that we talk about that are related to thinking differently, two that are related to acting differently. So Steve, why don't you and I split those up? I'll cover the first two. You can do the acting ones. So the very first principle around thinking differently, and again, hear these all as tricks you can use to kind of boil down to the fundamentals of what you're trying to achieve. So what the first principle is to focus on human behavior. And what we mean by that is companies in any industry have generally lost sight of what they're actually trying to accomplish in their value chain, in their value system. So if you think about a typical company, they take some sort of supply, they process that supply into something, then they put that something into the market and someone buys it, and then they rinse and repeat. And what most companies lose sight of is there are people at every step along the way. And if you want to change your performance, if you want to change your, for example, growth trajectory, steady state, maybe you're predicting 1% growth for the foreseeable future, but that steady state does not change unless someone somewhere changes a behavior. I don't care how digital a company you are, we are still people in companies. And if you can identify the behavior that has the most economic upside, then you will, and disproportionately focus your resources on driving that behavior, then you will be successful. It's that simple. But, you know, human behaviors are hard to understand, they're hard to predict, and they're much more expansive than where typically companies go when we first start talking about human behavior, which is to the customer. Yes, customer behaviors are important, but so are supplier behaviors and increasingly partner behaviors and regulator behaviors and so on. And so if any company, including a radio company, can just start to conceive of its value system, its value chain as a series of interconnected behaviors and focus only on the ones that matter most, that's a great way to get back to just the fundamental principles of what is going to make us successful. So that's the first one. I'm happy to move on to the second, but let me pause there. Any reaction or commentary?
It's the fresh start, really.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Break it apart and start fresh.
And it is really tied to the second one, which you mentioned around thinking differently, which is to bring a beginner's mind. I think at this point, that concept is sufficiently well talked about. Steve Jobs talked about it for a long time. Mark Benioff from Salesforce, it's one of his key touchstones. And it's a concept, as you may know, or as you may have seen in the book, that is stolen from the world of Zen Buddhism. And there's a quote in Suzuki's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which I always mash up just a little bit, but it's something along the lines of, in the beginner's mind, there are many options. In the expert's mind, there are few. And what has been the reality of business over time is that people with expertise get promoted, and their opinion matters more. And they get to call the final shots because they've been there, done that, seen it. And if you can rely on expertise, then you can drive more efficiency into your business model. That's why, very simplistically, that's why expertise is valued in companies, because the purpose has always been to drive efficiency. But if we're now living in a world that is not about taking risk out of decisions, but facing the unknown and in some cases unknowable and dealing with uncertainty, then the experts are not necessarily going to have it right. Been there, done that, no longer carries the day. And actually what you need to be able to do is to bring that beginner's mind to open up the aperture again. By definition, what you're doing as an expert is you're closing down the range of possibilities that you see to potential solutions. And what you heard Steve describe before when he talked about Chip Berg at Levi's is coming in and admitting, look, he doesn't know the apparel industry necessarily. He doesn't have all the answers, but he could see things that others didn't see because he was not so embedded in the orthodoxy of the apparel business to be able to just carry on with the traditional playbooks. So bringing that beginner's mind, whether it's literally getting a beginner into the room and saying, what's the stuff that you see in here that just looks like it's a waste of time or you just don't get, or valuing a broader array of opinions when you're dealing with uncertainty, that's absolutely critical to getting this right.
Yeah. And if I were to, if focusing on behavior and bringing a beginner's mind are the thinking differently principles, the acting differently principles are about making minimally viable moves and embracing impermanence. And there, I'd actually say making minimally viable moves is something that the radio business has been historically actually pretty good at. I mean, the radio business was characterized by, we'll put anything on the air to try it out once and we'll see if it works. And because there's not a lot of risk in not trying something new. So, but what I'd say is that the radio business made those moves within the context of a, you know, relatively narrow business model, experimenting with different formats, different, you know, degrees of live, not live, DJ, you know, all sorts of different radio formats. And now the question might be what moves might the companies who have legacy radio businesses try out to see to what extent they can change consumer behavior. And so it's really important, we think, to make minimal viable moves, to try things out so that you're not risking the entire organization when you try something that's new. And there's nothing like, you know, a world of declining margin, increasing competition to stoke creativity and trying something different.
And I will say, if I could just jump in there super quick, Steve, if your listeners that think they're hearing something familiar in the term minimally viable moves, they are, absolutely. It's a ripoff from the world of product development, where for a long time, people have talked about minimally viable products, that the way to effectively develop a product is essentially develop the smallest possible improvement to something that you've either got in the lab or is in the market already, and then put it into the market to see what the reaction is. A minimally viable move is just the same idea, but applied to any sort of business action, where what we're trying to say is have a hypothesis about what you're trying to achieve, identify the smallest possible step forward so you're not taking on undue risk, and then see what the reaction is. And if you get a positive...
Right. And that aspect of a small step is super important. There was a time, Jeff referenced earlier, that the time that I was in industry, and I was at Forbes magazine at you know, in and around 99, 2000. And there was a technology that we were looking at called the QCAT. Buzz, I'm not sure if you recall the QCAT, but it was, you know, kind of in the advertising space. Everything, you know, hinges around the degree to which you can demonstrate, you know, return on investment for an advertiser. And this was a technology that would allow our readers to scan a barcode on an ad, and then that would redirect you to a website for further information. It was a great way to create more engagement with the magazine, but also demonstrate to advertisers a return on their investment, something that's also important, you know, to the radio business. And it was certainly a behavior that was worth testing the extent to which we could create it. The challenge was that the QCAT was a wired device, not a wireless device, which was back in 99, 2000. And so it didn't cause the behavior change that we had hoped. But because we were trying to be bold, we sent a million of those QCATs to our subscriber base, which was way more than we needed to send in order to discover that behavior didn't exist. We could have gotten that same learning, tested our hypothesis by sending it to 30 folks around the office. And so the reason why we're emphasizing the minimal viable move is just we know that we need to learn about new behaviors that could create value. It's just that we don't want to take such big risks that we risk the entire organization, you know, failing as a result of that. And so that's minimally viable moves. Let me maybe pause there to see if you've got any reactions, Buzz.
We've been unfortunately pushed into a position of having to be frequently cautious about any moves,
yeah.
Right? I mean, because business and competition is tighter, and the way we're judged in this day and age is, you know, around far more disruptive factors. So I think, you know, that we've allowed ourselves to be pushed into that position, I guess.
But the natural human reaction to that, which is to wait, to analyze, to gather more data, to predict, to really make sure you've got your buttoned-up analysis done before you go try something, is completely opposite to what needs to be done to understand an uncertain world. And so one of the playbooks that we talk about in the book that we want to blow up is this whole notion of celebrating failure. So there's this ridiculous myth in the world of innovation these days that if you celebrate failure, you must be innovative. And honestly, that's just I'll use a polite term, completely wrongheaded. Because if you failed, it just means that you've waited too long to make a move. It means that failure in my book is taking on undue reputational or economic, taking an undue economic or reputational hit because you've waited too long. And so as we talk about it, you know, as we move from this world of risk management to uncertainty management, the only way you add contours to uncertainty is to provoke a reaction from the market. And the only way you can provoke a reaction from the market is go do something. So waiting and analyzing and using past data, by definition, anything you analyze is about the past, which is a ridiculous way to look forward to the future. But waiting and doing more analysis is not the way to handle uncertainty. Going and doing something really small, so you're not exposing yourself to risk, undue reputational or economic hit, is the best way to actually start to add some lines around what that uncertainty might be.
Yeah, and then to just fill in the last principle, if you say the best thing I can do in the face of, you know, uncertainty about the future is to try some new stuff to see how it works, to see how it changes behavior, then the other mindset you need to bring is, even if it's you're lucky enough to be successful, or you're smart enough to be successful with some of those minimally viable moves and you're able to scale them, you can't get so recommitted to those things that you don't see if they start to wane themselves over time. So the last principle is embracing impermanence. Because if you believe the world is going to continue to move really quickly, then the stuff that may have worked for a while isn't going to be a permanent solution to anything. So even when you've had great success, you've got to be willing to toss that out in the future if it starts to show sign that it's past its sell-by date. So, you know, we want organizations to absolutely be on this journey of continually testing and learning about the extent to which they're able to cause and then continue to change customers' behaviors in a manner that's advantageous to them.
Jeff Tuff, Steve Goldbeck, thanks for being here, and thanks for helping us light the fuse.
Thanks for having us on, Buzz.
Thanks for having us, Buzz. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Healthy Paranoia with the special guests Jeff Tuff and Stephen Goldbeck, the authors of Detonate, Why and How Corporations Must Blow Up Best Practices.
Thanks for listening to Healthy Paranoia with Buzz Knight. Production assistance provided by Boston Beasley Media Group's Mark Clark.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.